Hi, this is Raz, one half of the famous podcast duo. And before we get into the heart of this particular podcast, and I have to say, it's a very moving story with the brilliant Brooke Kinsella. And she's so honest and raw and funny and just, I'm always in awe of her. And I think you will be once you listen to this. But before we get to that, we'd really like it if you enjoyed this episode and you've enjoyed some others in the past, that you could possibly follow us or subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And if you, once you've listened to this episode, if you could possibly rate and review it, then that helps us reach more people, apparently, and that will help us keep the podcast going, apparently, and it's win, win, win. So do that for me, and now this. Let's go with it. Here we are. Are we ready, team?
We're ready.
I'm going to start this off.
Yeah.
And you know, it's starting is hard. So let's pretend that I'm someone with enthusiasm. I'll do this. Hello. No, I can't do that. It's too enthusiastic. Hi. Hello. Hi. Hi. Oh, I hate it. And Hannah normally starts. Oh,
it was your decision.
I can't do the starting business. Hi. No, that's
rubbish. You have to be. You can be grumpy as usual if you want.
Okay, let's do a downbeat version. Hi. No, that's too downbeat. Okay.
Hi, I'm Raz Shaw, and I'm a theatre director and lately a bit of a writer. And I've been very close to it three times.
And I'm Hannah Harris, and I'm a doctor, and sadly, I see a lot of it in my job.
In this podcast, we're going to be talking about the elephant in all our rooms.
Death.
Each week, we're going to be speaking to guests we admire and asking them, amongst other things, to curate their own memorial service.
In order to peel back the layers of their life so far.
I hate that word, lost him. We didn't lose him. He was stolen. There's the truth. He was stolen from us through knife crime.
What they do or don't hold dear.
And you know what? Even at the age of seven, playing somebody else and not being Brooke, I loved it.
Their take on their own mortality.
And how they want to be remembered at the end of their lives.
I taught her how to clap and you would think that she'd discovered the cure for corona. And I was like, yes! And that's an achievement to me.
A kind of desert island death, if you like.
Well, that's good. So, welcome to our brand spanking new podcast, Death and the Elephant.
Now, hi. Welcome to this episode of Death and the Elephant, the podcast. And it's more than a privilege this afternoon to introduce my amazing friend, Brooke, to our podcast. Hi, Brooke.
Hi, Coach. How are you doing?
I'm very good. Oh, that might have to be explained at some point. Now, Brooke was an actress. Delete is appropriate. She is a brilliant agent. She is a campaigner. She is an inspiration. She is also, as of how many months ago, a mother.
Eight months. Can you believe it?
That is genuinely bonkers. What would you describe yourself as, Brooke?
Oh my goodness, we've started straight away, haven't we? Do you know what? First of all, I mean, this is why you are my coach, Razzle. I kind of need you to follow me around in life and giving me the big sell because you
that
make
might seem a bit weird.
It would, yeah. My husband might not appreciate it. Yeah. You do make me sound rather wonderful. What would I describe myself? I mean, look, the silly answer would be jack of all trades, master of none. I think right now, actually. Primarily, I am a new mum finding her way in that new adventure.
Yay!
That's been interesting. Job-wise, I am definitely an agent. I am now on the other side of the camera and I look after actors, which again is very interesting. And definitely, yes, still a campaigner. It's a huge, huge part of my life. It's really hard to just sum me up in one thing. It's,
that's why I asked, because I couldn't do it.
There you go. Hannah did it.
Yeah.
The multifaceted Brooke
She's
Kinsella.
Good.
She Brooke, good. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
No, pleasure. Thank you for having me.
What I want to ask first is, before we go on to the elephant questions, is how did you and Raz meet?
It's so funny because we had a little lunch the other day and I actually said to him, I don't know if you remember, Raz, I know how we met. We met, Raz was directing a play called Torn at the Arcola Theatre and he kindly chose me as a member of his cast. But I don't remember the point that we actually became such good friends. And I say this to Raz and I have drunkenly said it to Raz, like, I don't think you liked me. So the short answer is I back in my actress days, I did a play that Raz directed brilliantly, that sadly got interrupted a bit before its time for me that maybe we'll come on to a bit later. I don't know. He's been a huge part of my life ever since, to the point where he is my life coach. And that is why I call him coach. And I go to him with pretty much, well, all of my problems in life. And he talks me down and talks me round and tells me what I should do.
Aww, well, that all sounds very beautiful. Like that
sounds amazing. The only problem with that is, look, I had a 50th birthday a few years ago and Brooke made a little speech. And one of the things she said...
I've seen that speech, actually. I loved it.
One of the things she said in the speech was that when she first met me, and I don't think this is necessarily the way I want to be known as a director. So she did say... She did say in my 50th birthday speech that I was the meanest man that she'd ever worked with. Now, I'm not sure that's 100% true. Before we get into how our friendship evolved from me being... I mean, it isn't the first time someone said it, but they don't normally say...
I can definitely say at that point of working with you, and I do apologise because I can't really remember what I said in that speech. A little bit of the wine witch got to me.
The wine witch.
At that age and that point, and you know, the truth comes out when you're drunk, Razzle. I could definitely say at this point in my life, you are by far not the meanest man I have worked with. And you have more than made up for any meanness that I might have imagined. There you go.
Well, when you say meanness, I'm sure you meant I was quite tough on you.
Was it the prickly exterior before you got to the soft bit inside?
It was absolutely exactly that. And you know what? He still does the same thing, but now I know and love him. It's not meanness. It is that tough love. It's exactly that. But, you know, anyone who doesn't know Raz when they first meet him might think he does have a prickly exterior. We know better, obviously.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it is an exterior and an interior. But anyway, let's get to that, because obviously, you know, the weird thing is, as we know in this industry, as an actor, as a director, is that when you work together and we didn't know each other. We met each other at an audition or maybe a recall. I can't remember if there were one or two auditions or whatever. You were probably so good that it was just one audition. And
yes,
we knew
one take
that.
Wonder. There you go.
One take wonder.
Got the
but,
job.
You know, what would we rehearse for 4 weeks? It's quite an intense play and had a kind of amazing, intense cast.
What was the play, by the way?
It was a play called Torn by Femi Ogans. And it was a kind of beautiful, it was a love story between a Nigerian man and a Jamaican woman. I learned so much from that play. One of the things I didn't know was there's a lot of interracial bigotry you know, or at some point in history. I think it's a lot better now, but it's not just smooth going. And there was a lot of really interesting things being discussed. But even in the heart of something so deep and interesting, you get to know your actors pretty well, and you get to a point where you think, you know, that's where the lovey thing comes in. You get close quite quickly, and it's not, I don't think it's false close, but also it's not necessarily lasting close. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's quite an intense shared experience, I guess.
It's a bit of a shared experience, but we didn't know each other that well. And then as Brooke said, on the Saturday night of the press night was the horrific day, evening, morning, early Sunday morning, where Brooke's brother got murdered, and that's, you know, something that
I remember calling Raz the next day. Do you remember Raz saying, I'm coming to work, I'm coming
Did
in,
you?
Don't worry. And he was just like, Brooke, stop it. And in my, you know, there's Dr. Theatre, which the show must always go on, whether you've got a broken leg. I mean, I think the loss of your brother might be excused.
But you genuinely meant it.
I did.
As you were saying it. Yeah, I'm coming in tomorrow. I was like, you're not coming in tomorrow. I mean, and
probably
it's a
not
shock.
Again.
Not again. Well, you did come in again.
I did.
Right near the end. But I mean, the shock of that moment obviously makes you not think what the, you know, what the hell's going on. But I guess one of the reasons we became friends, and I don't really remember, and you certainly won't, because you were just, you know, inside that mm-hmm. horrific moment. And so, but I think it's something to do with, because it's not a real, death isn't a taboo to me. It's something to do with opening up a pathway, not necessarily consciously on my part anyway, that allowed you either to talk about Ben's death or not to talk about Ben's death.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? And
yeah.
and at some point to be able to talk about something else, whenever that was. And I don't remember one of the things that Brooke immediately knew she wanted to do was this thing that has now become this, was set up a trust in Ben's name. And we sort of, you know, quite quickly started to make a gala thing, which was only about 6 weeks later. We did mm-hmm. this gala which was sort of the start of the Ben Kinsella Trust. And so we sort of got lost in doing that together, and we still didn't know each other. And I think the ability, you know, if I have any skill. No, okay. Don't shout me down,
sorry.
Anyone.
What?
Big
what do you mean?
Fair.
You have so many.
No, but if I have any skill, it's to just sort of prick the moment in enabling people to smile or even to laugh. And at that time, that's not a thing that you ever imagined, correct me if I'm wrong, that you would ever do again.
No, absolutely. I mean, in those early days, I swore I would never laugh again. I swore I'd never eat again. And you're so right, Raz. And that is a wonderful skill of yours. I think another skill, actually, we might as well give you, we'll throw you
Come
a bone.
On.
We'll throw
props,
you a bone.
Props are due, right?
And, and it was very much that it was the first fundraiser thing we'd ever done, the first gala, the first event, if you ever like, in memory of Ben. And it was the start of the Ben Kinsella Trust. And what you are brilliant at is when somebody does have an idea and sits there and goes, oh, well, what about, you say, do it. Don't just talk about it, do it. And you made that happen 6 weeks after, you know, we lost Ben, where I might have just been going, oh, you know, and probably might have, you know, put it to one side and maybe wouldn't really be here today, and neither would the Ben Kinsella Trust. And so you're quite good at making people take that leap.
Wow, I didn't realise Raz had been so fundamental in the evolution.
I didn't until just now, actually.
I think she's bigging it up a little bit, but that's sweet. But also because, I mean, do you remember that period? I mean, is it just a blur? What?
It's, I mean, pretty much my whole life is obviously defined. It's, you know, before Ben, after Ben. And I actually don't remember a lot of before Ben. And I think, you know, having done some therapy around it, that it is the brain's way of protecting you. And I wish that I could remember how happy I was before, Ben, but it's almost like my brain doesn't allow me to go to that point. So not only do I not really remember those very early days or months, probably years actually, since losing Ben, I don't remember much before Ben either. I remember the night of the performance. I remember coming back and doing that. My overriding memory of the whole job, Raz, actually is Foursquare.
Every actor listening now.
I think we spent
more
time playing Foursquare than we did rehearsing, actually.
What a great actor's game.
Yeah. But no, I don't remember. And obviously, you know, as part of my campaigning, I'm quite often asked to talk about those early days and how did you set up your campaign and how was it so successful? And I really do struggle with that because, I mean, the first thing is we had so many wonderful people like you helping. But secondly, I don't remember, sadly. And, you know, kind of 12 years on, we're doing wonderful things and organically have grown and developed in different ways than I ever thought we'd do. But yeah, I don't remember much at all. I think there was probably a lot of alcohol again.
I read your book. It's called Why Ben, A Sister's Story of Heartbreak and Love for the Brother She Lost. And you describe it incredibly and, you know, really movingly how it felt that in that first, you know, the first days, weeks, months. But so how long after Ben died did you write the book?
So thank you, first of all, for taking the time to read it. That is, yeah, that's wonderful. I think I started, I guess, almost keeping a diary. The book was published a year after we lost Ben, maybe a bit longer, actually. But I think I started almost like a diary. And the book, you know, is very much like a diary, just kind of jotting thoughts down. And actually, after proofreading it for the last time, I've never revisited it and read it. And maybe I should, because it would probably give me back some of those memories, yeah, but maybe I don't quite want them.
I mean, it was really difficult to read. It's so sort of honest and raw.
Bless you. And, you know, I think about that. I was 25, 26, and I've got a sister that age now. And I guess even just going through what we went through at that age was horrific. I know, I mean, in my head, I'm still only 16 anyway, obviously. But yeah, much older. We definitely are much older.
Definitely am not.
I, you know, I'm older. I don't feel so much wiser, but I kind of, when I think about that 26-year-old, and I guess actually it's probably one of the questions that we will come on to at some point about achievements. To have written that book, age 26, thinking about it, that's an achievement. My head is growing and expanding.
No, let it grow because it deserves to grow. That is huge, and it's huge anyway, but it's huge to be able to be as you say, in the blur of grief, horrific grief, to have the wherewithal to just go, well, I'll just keep writing some things down every day and I'll keep writing this thing and it turns into a book. And also, as you know, for me, your book was the inspiration for me to write my book.
Oh, was it?
Because one day, one day Brooke was at my house and I was like, oh, I'll write a book. And there it was on my shelf. And she said, have you read my book? And I said, well, it's on my to read list. I will read it at some point. And she said, well, look, if I can write a book, you can, Russell. And so I read it and it is kind of unbelievably beautiful. And I was like, oh, I don't, again, a little bit like, you know, like you said, it was hard to, when you listen to Julia's podcast, but following your book was really difficult because it was, you know, unbelievable. And so, yeah, it gave me inspiration.
And I actually have a dedication in Razzle's book, which is one of my proudest, loveliest things, in which he says, thank you for that. So yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. But that's interesting that it's a blur. Do you remember, is there anything that you remember in terms of the first thing you fully, that seemed to be fully in focus that you remember post, you know, Ben's death?
Yes, and I guess what that is probably again the start of the public campaigning, And that was, there was a march. So in the very early days of Ben's death, and again, you know, he was 16 years old. And I guess I should probably just say, and we don't want to make this doom and gloom, and it mustn't be, but we're talking about death, just for anyone who's thinking, well, who's Brooke and who's Ben and what happened? He was 16. He went out one night, he'd just finished his GCSEs. He went out to celebrate finishing his GCSEs. And he never came home again, and we lost him. I hate that word, lost him. We didn't lose him. He was stolen. There's the truth. He was stolen from us through knife crime. So that was a very much a world that I was aware of, heard about, definitely thought, well, that's, you know, a certain lifestyle and certain areas, and that's never going to happen to me. And then it did. And it was, you know, I felt very guilty for every time I'd heard on the news that, you know, we'd lost someone to knife crime, and I just got on with my day. But so that's how we lost Ben, in a very horrific and, you know, unnatural way. And in the early days after losing Ben, his young friends, who again were 15, 16, 17, organized a march, in his name to say no to knives. And literally in a matter, I think it was about 4 or 5 hours, 500 people gathered in the streets of Islington. Wow. And I remember we marched, and I remember that march, and I was at the front with my sisters. And we got to the end of the march. We marched to the place where Ben had died, and there was a little wall, and all of the news channels were there. And somebody said to me, get up and say something. And I was just like, what do you mean? Say what? And I was pushed up onto this wall. And again, I was 25. And all of these cameras were on me, and I couldn't tell you what I said that day. It was obviously played a lot on the news. I could probably find it. But it's almost like it wasn't my voice that came out, because I didn't really have a clue what I was talking about. It was almost as if it was, and it sounds crazy silly, but it was Ben's voice. And that to me was the start of our campaign to use Ben's story and Ben's legacy to stop this happening to somebody else. And that's amazing. Kind of my very first overwhelming memory.
Clear memory.
Yes. Yeah.
And so really it sounds like you were thrust into the limelight on the back of this terrible thing that happened, partly because of your kind of profile. Mm-hmm. So that must have been on top of grieving the loss of your brother, then having to sort of take on that responsibility, that must have been a massive pressure.
It do you know what? It really was. I guess at the time, and again, you know, we're now kind of a good 10 years on, at the time, it was more of a selfish thing, in that I didn't want Ben to be forgotten. He was, you know, I mean, he was 16, I was 25, but I still lived at home, and he was very much one of my best friends in the world. You know, I was very lucky with all of my siblings, and still am, that we were all so very close. And so, you know, he would hang out with me a lot. He was really funny. I know it's very easy to kind of look back when you lose somebody and only see the good in them. And I don't with Ben. I know, I remember how, you know, he was an annoying, typical teenage boy in many ways, but he had this old soul about him, and everybody says that about him. And I just really liked hanging out with him, to be honest. So it, you know, it was very hard going through the personal loss and all of everything that came with that, and then absolutely, like you say, being thrust into this limelight. Because as much as I'd obviously been in EastEnders, and that comes with that's a whole double-edged sword that we can touch on. That comes with a lot of pressure and limelight. But I was very much used to, you know, playing characters and reading scripts, and that's all I'd ever done in my life. And then at the age of 25, I was, you know, given access to and being asked to talk to and do reports for the Home Office, the Prime Minister, some of the most important people in our country. Nobody to hide behind, just me, this little cockney girl. Yeah, you know, who says in it a lot.
It was one of my favourite things. One of my favourite things is texting Brooke or something, or speaking to her on the phone, or I can't remember, saying, because she was supposed to come around for tea. She said, yeah, I'm coming around for tea. Just go have a cup of tea with David Cameron, and then I'll be around. So it's like, oh, okay. All right.
Your impression of me, we need to do some work on that, Raz, please.
What?
It's not enough by far.
Oh, okay. Oh, I can go there. No, but it's but that's the remarkable thing about you. And one of the things I'm sure you haven't seen because you haven't watched it, is the day after Ben was murdered, there was a press conference. And you were the spokesperson for your family.
Yeah, again,
when Torn reopened a few days later, we had a little moment at the beginning where I quoted from that press conference, because you said something like, I can't remember the exact thing, boys and girls, put down your knives and all that kind of stuff. And for someone who always claims she's not articulate and she's not, you know, all that kind of stuff, in that moment, the day after that horrific event, you were so bloody articulate. And yes, that moment is all a blur, and then cut to when that march was. So there's something inside you.
Yeah.
That is able to express those things, even if you don't. If you yourself think that the words are expressed in whatever way they are, they're expressed in a brook, in a very brook articulate way, and that has to be innate in you.
Yeah, the strength and the poise you must have inside.
I mean, that is, it's very kind. And I don't remember. I mean, I do now. Well, I don't remember it. I know that it happened, but mainly because there are images online of that press conference. But yeah, it is a blur. It's just. I guess what it is I think it was somebody who, like I said, you know, I never expected this to happen to me. And I think a lot of people kind of, you know, that lived the life I had, I was an actress, but I was just a working class, you know, white person. And I think people quite often thought that it was gang culture and, you know, it wasn't going to touch anybody who lived any kind of the life that I did. And it did. And I think I was just obviously very honest about that. And, you know, and I was ashamed that I hadn't, I guess, done more, but, you know, hindsight is a great thing. And what you can't beat yourself up about that. But I go back to what I said, I guess, at the beginning of this, in that I think it was very much Ben's story. It's absolutely Ben's story. But Ben's fight and his voice that kind of led us on the path to today.
Yeah.
So you were ashamed that you hadn't done enough before Ben was killed.
Mm.
Is that?
Yeah, and I guess it's a silly thing. I'm a bit older, but yeah, because you do think if I had, would he still be here? And I know the silliness of that as I say it out loud, but yeah, it's always that what if,
you can't campaign about everything all the time, can you?
Yeah, absolutely.
But just because we're there at that point, let's just talk for a second about the, you know, even though, you know, like you say, before Ben's death and after, but you were an actor from when? About
seven. Seven. Yes, my first.
How did that happen? I mean, I don't know your parents very well, but I don't see them as pushy parents.
Oh no, I mean, and also there is not like a theatrical bone in any other member of my family or myself. I mean, I'm very much a one-trick pony. Like Raz will.
No, come, you know, now, come on now.
Cannot sing or dance at all. So, I mean, how did it start? Believe it or not, I was a very, very shy child. And I mean, I was Matilda. I was the definition of Matilda. My head was always in a book and didn't have a huge amount of friends. And so my mum sent me to this local drama school called Anna Shears, which, you know, the alumni of that is everybody from Kathy Burke to, I mean, all the Cockneys, all the greats, you know, have passed through those doors. And I went, literally just an after school club. There were no jazz hands. You know, we were not the Sylvia Young's Italian.
What kind of school is this?
Oh, I mean, I used to describe it as like the ghetto of drama schools because, you know, we'd go to auditions and there would be these beautiful little ballerinas in their tap shoes and singing these, like, you know, Somewhere Over the Rainbow, and our audition song was like the Toblerone advert theme tune. There you go.
Yes.
Proved that I can't sing a note. We were the misfits, but I've got great, great memories of it. But however, in the beginning, absolutely hated it because again, it was just like having to come out of my shell, having to perform and make friends and just really didn't like it at all. And one day a casting director came in to scout for kids, and I was not one of the chosen ones at all. And it was for a new CBBC children's programme. And because I didn't really have any friends, poor me, and I had no one to sit with while she was sitting there watching these kids, I just went and sat next to her.
Oh, my God.
In my little bunches. I had bunches and striped dungarees. And I was just like, hello. What are you doing?
Hello.
Hello there.
Is that impression better?
Hello. That is, hello, my Dick Van Dyke. And she saw something in me, I guess. And she said, no, like, actually, you get up, you audition. And I got my first role, and it was a leading role in something called Mud, which people of my generation might know.
I got to see that YouTube Mud, everyone.
It's, give it a go. It's what my husband watched before our first date, which I could literally kill him for.
That's
and it
weird.
Starred Russell Brand and Russell Tovey. And yeah, I was in good company.
All-star cast.
Yeah. And you know what? Even at the age of 7, playing somebody else and not being Brooke, I loved it. Loved it. It allowed me to have this confidence. I don't know what it was.
You recognize the difference.
Absolutely, even at that age. And I just loved it. Even though I had no kind of background of performing, and it wasn't, you know, the family that I came from, like, they kept me grounded. You know, I'd be the only kid on set being spoilt rotten. I'd go home and, you know, do the ironing and do my chores and any kind of, you know, favoritism or any of that in my family. But I just, I knew the difference, and it wasn't like a job. It was just, it was for a very long time until, you know, it had to pay the bills. It was just a passion and a love, and it was just something that came so naturally that just stepping out of me into somebody else, I loved.
So weirdly, and I think it's sort of true when you were acting as an adult, certainly when I work with you, is slightly, you're slightly shyer when you stop. When you're on it, you're just in it and on it and fucking brilliant. But then you stop and have to be Brooke again.
Oh God. Yeah, absolutely.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
It's like, you know.
And so doing something like this, and Raz will know because I've messaged him like 100 times, like, if you haven't noticed yet, I've got quite a bit of imposter syndrome going on, but are you sure you want me? I just don't know. It won't be very good. So kind of talking about myself, or, you know, public speaking and being myself, absolutely petrifying. I mean, let me play a character. Not anymore. Obviously, I don't do it anymore. But, you know, give me a script. Give me a character. I much prefer that than being.
So that brings me on to another question, which is that you've stopped doing it now. You don't act anymore, as far as I know, at all. And I was just wondering, sorry if this is a bit of a difficult question, but often when people have suffered sort of quite a lot of a deep mental trauma, they sort of turn their back on what had come before that. Mm-hmm. So often people will end relationships, for example. But I just wondered if that happened to you with acting, and maybe that because of what happened to Ben and going through all that, you wanted afterwards not to have anything to do with acting anymore.
It's really interesting actually thinking of it like that. And actually, I very much did end a relationship pretty soon after, and a long-term one that I'd been in for 5-6 years after losing Ben. So that's wow. Really interesting. And strangely enough, I went back to, I was only 25. It sounds like, you know, I was 40 and I've been married 5 times, but I went back to my very first boyfriend when I was 16. That was my very first love, if you like. And I think part of me was trying to go back to that old happy Brooke. Now being a little bit older, pre-Ben, absolutely trying to make my life back into that. The giving up acting, it came a bit later. I carried on for a bit. I think probably what happened though is the campaigning side took over and took up a massive amount of my time, and starting Ben's Trust, I became an advisor to the government. I I did a report where I went around the country researching knife crime projects. That took up many, many months.
And you went to America, didn't you?
Went to America and went and looked in prisons and boot camps and, God, I forgot about that. Thanks, Raz. it just became who I was for a long time. And I think acting at some points felt a bit frivolous to me. It was all I could do at that point, for sure. I didn't know it. I hadn't trained in anything else. I didn't know how to do anything else, but it just all seemed a bit silly to be worrying about auditions and if I didn't get them, and I was doing these really important things. And then I just, I guess, became known for that, and that made it a bit harder to get acting jobs. And and kind of time went past very quickly, and I was still working. You know, I did bits here and there, and I was actually working the day that I decided to stop working and become an agent. I was doing Alan Ayckbourn with Alan Ayckbourn, and that's an incredible gig. So I was working. It wasn't like I hadn't worked in a long time. But I think the work had slowly, you know, started to get slower and slower. And I was 30. I was becoming an age where I felt like I had to grow up and, you know, have some stability, and was in a relationship with an actor who was also a jobbing actor. And just, I think I just got to the point where I was like, well, look, one of us has to pay the bills.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense.
Yeah. And it just felt like, and actually alongside all this, what I probably should say is I started after Ben, one of the things I did to kind of channel my energy into is I started a young children's performing arts school, very much like Anna Shears, where I had gone all of my life, in a little church hall, just for kids to come and hang out and have fun and get some confidence and mess around with performing if they wanted. And I started to get the kids little bits of work through that. And that was what kind of led me on the path of, oh, this agenting business, I like this. And I realized I was getting more excited making those phone calls and getting those opportunities for other people than I was when my own agent called me and said, you know, got an audition for you. So I think it was just like a natural, lots of things falling into place and just getting to a point in life going, look, you've not kind of made it big time. You've been doing this for well over 20 years now. Is it time to give it up? And I did. And do I sometimes look back and think, what if? Yes, I do.
Well, I suppose it's never too late.
It's never too late. And also, well, we'll just come on to that never too late thing in a second. But the interesting thing is that, you know, like you said, you became known as a campaigner more than an actor. But one of the reasons why the, you know, you were fronting the news conferences and stuff and the march is because of your profile of being an actor before Ben's death. But that, and Hannah and I were talking about it yesterday, it's about, you know, and me and you have talked about it a little bit about when do you have the chance to process what's happened? You know, even, what is it, 12 years? Is it 12 years? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. 12 years later, you know, if you're campaigning, you're living Ben's death every single moment of your campaigning work, and therefore that's difficult.
Yeah,
that's,
that must be exhausting. You're obviously you're not going to forget about him or what happened, but you actually have to live and breathe it every day as part of your work.
Yes, and it was one of the reasons that we started the Ben Kinsella Trust, and fundamentally, it's a huge, immersive, interactive exhibition. We call it the exhibition. It's not really an exhibition, but it's six different rooms. There is a Ben's room that tells you all about Ben and his life and who he was. And then there is a cinema room that tells you about what happened that night and is quite dark and heartbreaking. And we have like a choices and consequences room that tells you all about the laws and the, you know, health and safety around knife crime. We have a real prison with actors in. So we set up this exhibition and we based it very much on the Anne Frank exhibition that my family had visited. And we just thought, this is brilliant. How can we use this to tell Ben's story? Quite simply because I couldn't keep going into schools and prisons telling this story every day because, I mean, firstly, it becomes robotic. It loses the impact and the meaning behind it. And it's just, exhausting and draining, and yet you never can then get on with life. And I actually don't think that I gave myself the time out of life to think about everything that's happened until I got pregnant last year, actually.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, and it was a choice. I kept myself so busy in those kind of definitely the first 5 years because I didn't want to allow myself to stop because I was worried what would happen if I did. And so I just kind of kept going. And it was only when there was a global pandemic and I was pregnant and I was forced to sit still and not leave my house that I was able to maybe think a bit more about things.
And where did that lead you in your mind?
There were some really tough times, and I think I'd spent a lot of time allowing memories to come in, and sometimes they're lovely and funny and laughing, and allowing memories to come in and having an absolute breakdown. And I've got a Ben box with some little mementos. I've got I took him to a gala of Wicked, the theatre show, and I've got that ticket. I've got his toothbrush. Like I say in the book, I kept his toothbrush in case he could ever be cloned, and weirdly a pair of his boxer shorts that he's probably going, what, that is so weird. And so I will have moments where I'll get all them out and I'll cry for about 3 hours and I lock it away. But I kind of let those feelings come when I was, you know, sitting around not doing much last year. And there were days for the kind of safety of myself and my baby and my sanity that I had to go, no, that's enough. But actually, it did allow me, I guess, to process some stuff. And I think what was very important is becoming a mum. Losing a sibling is something that is almost impossible to describe unless you are one. And I wouldn't wish it on anybody. But I never knew really what my mum and dad had been through. And now I can picture that. And that's petrifying to me now. Now I'm a parent myself. And I kind of had to let myself just go to the edge of thinking about that and then just pull back and go, okay, don't. But it's given it a whole new layer, I guess, of heartbreak.
An emotion.
And so, the beautiful Elsie...
Yeah.
Who I met a few weeks ago for the first time.
And charmed completely.
So we'll always be completely interlinked with Ben.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I want her to be. I want her to know how wonderful he was. It's a conversation that I'll have to have. And how do I have that? You know, I haven't figured that out yet because, you know, talking about Uncle Ben and he's an angel in heaven and, you know, however you think about wherever people go after, having that conversation with children is tough. But explaining why he isn't here is going to be hard. And what age do I want her to know that? But I don't want to shy away from her Uncle Ben. I want her to know all about him.
And well, let's talk a little bit about Ben's creative writing story. Mm-hmm. Because actually, when we, like you, I don't know about the chronology, but a few years after Ben died, and you were still an actor, we talked a lot. So we talked a lot about you. Us working on this story. Can you talk about the discovery of the story?
So it was, I mean, there were so many just kind of crazy, wonderful, heartbreaking, beautiful things. One of the first things we found in his English coursework book was in the early days of when we were deciding, okay, what is Ben's campaign and legacy going to look like, is I had a meeting with Gordon Brown.
As you do.
Definitely got far too drunk the night before and was so hungover. And oh my goodness. Yes. Maybe edit.
I'm sure he's Scottish.
I'm
sure he's used to people breathing alcohol on him. It's fine.
Yeah, he probably commiserated. It's fine.
So me and my dad, we were going to see Gordon Brown and we were like, you know, what are we going to say to him? In the days after kind of losing Ben, I was being quite a bad big sister, I guess, and just like raiding his room, trying to find out new things about him because obviously when somebody dies and you know there's not going to be any new memories, that's heartbreaking. And so definitely found things that I wish I had not found in that hunt. Boys, teenage boy things. Put that in a box. But found his English coursework books, and in there was, unbelievably, a letter he had written recently to Gordon Brown, and they were asked to write about an issue in society they cared very deeply about, and Ben had written about how worried he was at the time about youth violence. And this letter for a 16-year-old boy was so powerful. And again, it made me ashamed because I didn't realise how worried he was about, you know, our society. And I certainly wasn't. It wasn't on my radar. I was just, you know, 25, living life in the nightclubs, you know, living my best life. And so that was the first kind of piece of his writing that we found and that we took to Gordon Brown. We took that letter to Gordon Brown, and it kind of, again, started us off. Okay, Ben wanted to make these changes in society. That's what we need to do. And then a bit later on, as Raz says, we were told about an essay he had written, again, for another piece of English coursework. And he basically, it's the weirdest thing, he described the way that he died pretty much to a T. He was stabbed 11 times, my brother, and he pretty much described every single one of those stab wounds that he got and how it happened in the beginning of this essay. And I started reading it and obviously couldn't breathe. But the beautiful thing about it is it goes on to describe him arriving in heaven and what heaven looks like to Ben, and whether you believe in heaven or not, it gives such comfort at the end of it, because he has put himself with his family in the most wonderful place. And, you know, that to my family was just, and now, you know, when we picture Ben, he's up there in his version of heaven that he wrote about before he left us, which is just,
I mean, that is just incredible that he predicted pretty much what was going to happen to him a few weeks later. I read the extract from it in the book, and it's just beautiful. What beautiful writing. He was so talented.
For a 16-year-old, I mean, I'm very proud of him.
Mm. It's unbelievable. Do you mind me reading a tiny bit from it?
No, of course not.
I mean, this is just the whole thing. When I read it again today, I've read it loads of times, because I'm coming on to talk about why I've read it loads of times. And we still might do the thing that we're going to do. But for a 16-year-old, I'm always just awestruck about how beautiful it is. And there's no doubt, you know, this young man was a writer, you know. The last paragraph goes, "So what will come next for me? God knows I don't. But for now, I'll return to the table my family humbly sit at." This is a 16-year-old. "This is my home now, and I've never felt better. I'm not scarred anymore. There's no weight on my shoulders, no struggle. From now on, I can do whatever I want, whenever I want. I'll never say I'm glad he did it, because, well, I'm simply not. But I much prefer it here than stuck on a weird world. Let's just see what a future here brings. But at the moment, this is living, not death."
Oh, I haven't read that in a very long time.
It's extraordinary.
Yeah. That is incredible.
We had a plan, didn't we, Brookster?
We did. And, you know, like when you sent me the questions to have a look at that you might ask me, the what is left to achieve in my life, that's probably up there, that one. We had a plan to use Ben's story and make it into a piece of theatre. And I would very much like to still do that, if you're still up for it.
I'm really up for that. The original plan, she sort of masking over the original plan, was Brooke, the great Brooke Kinsella, formerly of EastEnders, does her one-woman show based on this. And actually,
I was hoping you'd forget that bit. Oh, but maybe that's my comeback. There you go.
I haven't forgotten that, because the important thing about that is...
Yeah, I'm excited for this. When can I buy tickets?
It's going to be good. But the important thing about that is the fact that at that time, you just weren't ready to deal with this at all. You know, and, it, you know, obviously if we were in a rehearsal room and me being the meanest man in the world. then we'd have to get deep and down and dirty on the emotion. And it's not something that you were ready to deal with either in a one-woman show or in a or in something else. But
yeah,
but,
you probably needed at least a decade to sort of get yourself in the
Well, now
place.
You're an agent. We can get the actors in. That's easy.
Yeah.
We've got the director.
I need to get my clients some jobs, so
exactly.
There you go.
No, but
careful,
it is...
you're going to be signing on the dotted line at the end of this interview if you're not careful.
Am I going to have to audition? You will make me audition, won't
of
you?
Course, of course.
I know
course.
You.
You're going to do a recall on Zoom. But I think a lot about you reading that for the first time. Do you remember? So you remember that first time you came across it?
No, I remember the first time. I don't. I mean, even you just reading it now is kind of really got to me because it's another thing I haven't looked at in a long time. I remember when we first came across it, and I remember reading it to myself for the first time. And just it starts off horrifically, but ends beautifully. But I've not revisited it in a while.
No, it's extraordinary stuff. Well, let's keep talking about that little thing. We're gonna make it happen.
So easily persuaded, like folded like a pack of cards. I will never act again.
Well, I'm gonna hold you both to this. I can't wait. Happens.
If anyone out there wants to produce it, we're up.
Roll up.
Shall we get to some elephant questions, Hannah?
Yeah. There's one. I just wanted to go back to talking about having had your lovely baby, Elsie.
Yeah.
Obviously, having her during lockdown must have been an experience in itself. And I heard you say in an interview that you were quite fearful of having a baby because before you were pregnant, you were fearful of having a baby because of the world that you were bringing the baby into. So how do you feel about that now, having had Elsie?
I think the fact that she's a girl helps a bit. Like, I've got two nephews who are 4 and 6 who are the loves of my life. And I am still so scared for them. I'm scared on a daily basis because they still live in Islington and knife crime is still out. You know, I'd love to sit here now to you and say the work that the Beckinsella Trust has done has changed things. You know, there's good years and bad years, but actually right now we're still at a very bad point and it hasn't really got much better. And so I am still very much scared of the world that we live in and particularly for boys, although girls are caught up in this culture too. I moved out of Islington for that reason. You know, I didn't want to bring up children there. So I did that recently. And I guess I'm not so much scared for Elsie in a physical sense. I'm scared for her to kind of learn about the bad things in the world because I have been touched by them. Mm. But we cannot wrap up our kids in cotton wool. There are lots and lots of bad things going on in this world. And I hope she never experiences lots of them, but she probably will some of them. And, you know, you've just got to kind of be there to catch her when that happens. So, you know, I'm all right with it. But I wonder, had she been a boy, how different it would have felt.
Yeah, I'm sure. And apparently she looks a little bit like Ben. Is that right?
She really does. And like, there's so many crazy little things. So when I did the pregnancy test with Elsie, and it took us a little while to get her, actually. She was very much a long-wanted dream, and then she came along. But when I did the test, if you've ever done a pregnancy test, Raz,
you'll know.
On the pregnancy test, you get a code, and it's three letters, and then a load of numbers. And I pulled it out the box, and of course the three letters were Ben.
I didn't know that.
So I took a pic, and I just knew. I looked at it and said, "Oh, here it is. This is it." And I just knew. And I took a picture of it. I actually kept it for a long time. I've still got the wrapper, obviously, and I thought, this is a bit weird. I've got a stick of wee hanging around in my drawer. So I took a picture of it to, you know, tell this story. And it's lots of things like that. And then my mum sent me a picture comparing Ben when he was a baby to a picture of Elsie, and they are actually identical. And it's, you know, it's things like that that I, you know, I catch him not just in the wonderful mark that he's made in the world, but I look at my nephews, I look at Elsie, and I catch him there, and that's really lovely.
That's really amazing. Lovely. Oh, so moving on then now to our elephant questions.
Yes, the most important bit.
We've touched on this already. Your achievements, Brooke. What are you most proud of in your life so far? And what do you feel you still have left to achieve?
I guess, obviously, you know, my most recent and personal and best achievement is Elsie. It's, you know, and just, she's 8 months this week.
Eight months.
She's got two teeth. She's at nursery. Oh, I don't understand how this has happened.
At nursery.
I mean, look, any new first mum will tell you this. Every day that she is still here in one piece is an achievement for me. figuring out what to do is that's been an achievement. And you know, look, when I impart knowledge onto her, like, I taught her how to clap and you would think that she discovered the cure for corona. And I was like, yes. And that's an achievement to me. So look, personal recent achievement is for sure, you know, and I've got to say my daughter, I had to have some therapy because, as I touched on earlier, I do have imposter syndrome. Raz will agree. I'm not, this is like the worst question for me, is listing things that I've done good. But I actually had to do this for therapy homework. And I brought it back to the therapist and, you know, she was like, oh my goodness. And actually, when you put it in black and white, I've been very lucky. I've lived an incredible life. The job that I did as an actress allowed me to travel the world. I lived in the Arctic for 6 weeks in a tent and like tried to, I don't know if it's the North or South Pole, Razzle, some which pole. One would it be?
Some pole.
Had to journey there and I got to the finals and that was an achievement. So these are cool things that I can tell my daughter about, but I guess the book, I would say that we've spoken about the book, I wrote every word myself, literally every word. I had no help, aged 26.
It's beautifully written.
Thank you. That's an achievement. I think something very important that the campaigning and my family have achieved is the change in law around the tariff for knife crime sentencing. You know, for a long time, it was 15 years and the starting tariff, and the starting tariff for gun crime was 30 years. And we couldn't understand, you know, a weapon is a weapon, why there was that difference. And so we campaigned. And Jack Straw changed that law, and it's kind of, you know, informally known as Ben's Law, and they upped it to 25 years. And that, amazing. I guess that's an achievement. So when I have to list them out.
Yeah, please do.
There's been some.
There's been a few.
Yeah, I've got the MBE, obviously, Miss Big Ed, as it stands for, as I say, Miss Big Ed, that my dad locked in a glass cabinet literally on the way home from the palace because he said, I'll lose it. That's lovely recognition. But what do I have left to achieve? Do you know what? I'm quite happy. Oh, so boring. I'm quite happy with my lot. I love my little family. I'm happy on my sofa. I don't have big dreams and ambitions. Now I have a baby. You know, it was one of my things I always wanted. I'd love another one. I guess what I'd like to achieve maybe is some contentment and peace and confidence in myself. Going back to the imposter syndrome, just a bit of belief in that, look, you've done all these things that you've just said, and that's quite good.
Are you closer to it?
I think becoming a mum, I've definitely got a bit more confidence and a bit less worrying about the silly things in life because you just don't have time. You don't have time to worry about the things that would have kept me awake literally for days before. So I think I'm getting there in that sense. And you just kind of feel a bit more grounded in the world. You are responsible for another human. You've got to be a grown up most of the time. So yeah, I think I'm getting there.
It's really hard to get there. I can totally relate.
Do you have little ones?
I've got, she's actually not that little anymore. She's 20 and at uni.
Oh my goodness. Oh, you do not look old enough.
Thanks.
But yeah,
I'm keeping my mouth shut.
But being a mum changes everything though, and it does give you, I don't know, somehow gives you some more inner confidence because it's all about you. You're bringing up this little person, and it's really, really rewarding.
Yeah, I do feel that, and I hope that will continue. That's a bit of a boring answer. Sorry,
no, it's not a boring answer at all. Because the point is that this is a very honest answer, there's no age limit where you. And this sounds a bit guru-esque, but I don't think there's no age limit where you stop growing. And I said, I've just been up north opening the greatest play with the great Julie Hesmantage, and she's some kind of annoying guru to me. And she's always teaching me that, is that, you know, you're never too old to stop learning, to stop discovering new things, to stop growing and to stop trying to be a better person. And the moment we get stuck in our ways and in sort of the past, or in the past us, because, you know, we can look back in the past, but don't get stuck in the past you. Hmm. Be the right now you, whatever that means. And I think that your honesty allows you to be that, and you grow when you don't even know you do. I genuinely think that. And
yeah.
And so, you know, God knows in 30 years' time what you're going to be. Jesus.
Yeah. But my husband says when I met him, actually, so which was 5 years ago now.
Wow.
Yeah, about 5 years. He's always telling me, like, that he's waiting for peak Brooke. And I ask him on a daily basis, am I there yet? Am I peak Brooke yet? And he says, not yet, sweetie.
So
yeah, I guess I don't know when that's going to happen. You know, when I had Elsie, I said, oh, definitely I'm peak Brooke peak? Now. Still not
no.
yet.
No, still so, getting there.
Yeah, I'll let you know when it happens.
Let us know. No, it's no, but you're getting there. I think you're getting there. And that kind of leads to another elephanty question, which it would seem that we sort of covered, because it would seem obvious, but I think there's a kind of deeper version in there, because we talk about your forks in the road or your sliding doors moment, and you know, obviously it feels like Ben's death was something that we talk about that's before his death and afterwards, and that's a huge moment in time. But I guess Hannah and I were talking about this earlier about it's not. That's not really a fork in the road moment. That's just a fucking horrific moment.
Yeah.
I suppose that was maybe a sliding door. But forks in the road, I think of as being when you, there's a decision point and you choose one path or the other. And that, you know, that was kind of thrust upon you. But have there been any forks in the road where you chose one path and you wonder what had happened if you'd chosen the other one?
I guess coming back to, you know, what I touched on in that whole professional career in actor to agent, you know, and what might have happened had I stayed on that path, because I'd done it for 25 years and I, you know, I had a good run and I did some really lovely work. I was very lucky to work with some really mean directors. Yes. I can't think of any right now, but,
no,
but yet, no, I, you know, I'd done some, you know, I got like, oh, my mum's of, oh, I don't even, I can't say it out loud. Can we edit this out if it sounds so horrific? Like,
yes.
Obviously my mum and dad have got all the memories in the loft like mums and dads do, and she's cut out every single newspaper clip there ever was for me.
That's a mum's job.
And there was a review. I mean, it was probably The Sun, so, you know, we don't need to take too much of what they say as gospel, but it was a review of something that I did, and they said I would be the next Jodie Foster. And, you know, I have little flashes of that and think, oh, what might have happened had you been brave enough to carry on? I mean, look, I might be living in a cardboard box and it wouldn't have led me to where I am now with my husband and my daughter, who I love very much, and my job, which I do, you know, there are days where I want to get back into bed because, you know, actors are tricky. But
no, come on now.
Yeah. But yeah, I guess that is probably for me the biggest fork in the road.
Yeah.
I made a choice 6 years ago and I am happy and with that choice, but I do wonder where I would be now if I had not made that choice.
What might have been?
Yes.
Well, you know, when that producer comes knocking on our door to make this story.
Yeah. Well, I've lost any skill I had. I can't even the thought of literally sitting opposite you.
Oh, what? That's the imposter syndrome shining through.
I could not do it.
You
honestly.
Never lose that.
So I guess, I mean, the interesting thing about all of what we've talked about is, you know, the heart of the change it was Ben's death. And this podcast is obviously about death, but it's about your mortality. And I guess the question is, do you ever think about, you know, do you think about your death at all? You know, because you're so consumed in quite understandably in Ben and all of that. Is that something that you think about?
Absolutely. And I have gone through the roller coaster with this because, you know, in the early days of Ben, I didn't want to be here. I did not want to be here. I did not want to be alive, and had some quite horrible dark thoughts and even plans and thinking, but oh, you can't do that to your family. But it's, so I thought about my death a lot and my life a lot. I guess the one thing actually though is, you know, when you're young, you're scared of death. You're very scared of death. And losing Ben, I wasn't scared at all of death. In fact, I think I would have welcomed it. And, you know, in my head, I was like, if it happens, I don't care. I get to be with Ben, because in my head, Ben was in this heaven that he was just waiting for me somewhere that I would instantly get to go and be with him. And actually, that was, thinking about it, that was really hard, because when you would have your days and sit and cry, it was always because I was picturing Ben looking down at his family, like isolated from them, almost like he was trapped in this world where all he could do is look down. And it didn't really help this kind of idea of heaven. But I would have welcomed death really at any point. And then I guess as I got a bit older, and I'm a Catholic and I'm not practicing very much, but so I believed in heaven and afterlife and all of that. And my husband is very much an atheist and does not. And as you get a bit older and you read a bit more about science and things, and you start to think, oh, is there a heaven where everyone goes and just like watches you all the time? Probably not. And that almost brought a bit of comfort, because I was like, I believe that Ben's energy and essence is still here. I believe that you can't just disappear. You just can't. And like I said earlier, you know, I see him in many different ways, in many different people, but not thinking about him just hanging around looking down all the time actually helped in some way. And so what do I think about death? I mean, again, now I have a child, I don't welcome it. I don't want to leave her for a very long time. So I hope I stick around for a very, very long time. But I don't really have a fear of it, because I still think deep down, I think I believe that I will get to be with my brother, and therefore it'll be all right. So yeah, that's, I try not to think about my mortality.
No, no,
also because I'm quite clumsy. So, you know, oh, I'm God, probably at risk more than,
well, it's only weird. It's only weird people like me that like to think about death and all that shit.
But that's kind of a nice way for it to be then. You kind of, you know, it's there and you kind of don't mind, but also you love life. So
that is it in a nutshell. Absolutely. That's where I'm at right now. Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
And so how would you want to be remembered were it to happen?
Well, it will happen one day.
Yeah.
It will. Yeah.
I can guarantee you.
There's no getting away from it. I tried to, but Raz keeps reminding me.
Oh, yeah. Hannah is a doctor who's afraid of death. You know that.
I do know this. I do know this from listening to the podcast, which is just, brilliant. Like, absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I know. Contradiction.
And because of what you've witnessed, experienced, or did you always have the fear?
No, I had it my whole life from when I was really tiny. I was always terrified of it. And I'd talk to my mum about it all the time and be really scared. Oh, I suppose when you. I realised. Yeah. Yeah, so going into medicine was a big decision, because you do have to talk about it and think about it and experience it a lot with people.
Absolutely. Oh, bless you.
Yeah. But, you know, this is all therapy, basically.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, this is just like a free hour of therapy. This is wonderful. Yeah,
it's not free. It's not free.
No. Don't get nothing for nothing, do you, Raz?
In it,
right,
though.
How would I like to be remembered? Oh, that's really hard. I mean, look, I'd just like to be remembered. There you go. That'd be nice.
I think you might be.
I guess, I mean, look, amongst... I have to think about this one. I'd like to think that I've made some mark somehow. And actually, look, I'm going to get rid of the imposter syndrome and say, yeah, I think I have. I'd like to... Just, oh, a nice person's rubbish. Raz, can you help me? I do just want to be... Coach.
Well, I can't help you because it's got to come from your mouth. But if I was going to think about what you would be remembered for, is it someone who made such a huge difference, but but wasn't quite aware of the huge difference they were making in the moment, because you were just being Brooke. For, you know, right from the moment, right from before Ben's death, as an actor, you were just bumbling along, doing your thing, happened to be very successful. And then obviously, like I said, in the press conference the day after, your instinct took over, and then right to when you said the march and then the campaigning, and then now you're making a difference in the job you do to actors, even though some of them are quite annoying. And I think there's another chapter to come where whatever it is, it will combine all of those things. Then, yeah, obviously as a mother and a wife, but in terms of your, I think there's a whole heap of things to come that combines your campaign. It combines, you know, your creativity, which you don't think you have, but you do, and all those things. That's what I think anyway.
This is why you're my life coach. Okay, well, let's revisit that, like, on the second series of this podcast.
Yes.
And maybe I'll have a better answer for you then.
No, well, I will happily come back to have more of this top chat. Top chat. So then, with this kind of not knowing how you might be remembered, what's your dream of how your memorial service would be?
Oh, well, I mean, obviously they've got, I mean, I know this, don't you worry, I've planned this. We had it for Ben's. We asked everybody to wear bright colours, fancy dress. And
it was
very
amazing.
Much, it was amazing. He would have, you know, been looking down and have been very impressed and proud at the turnout for him. I would want it to be happy, especially if I, you know, I hope I die at a very old age and that it's, you know, that I've got some children there and I don't want them crying or sad. I want it to be as happy as possible. There absolutely has to be garage music because Ooh. That is, you know, what I'm known for.
Is it?
I didn't really know that.
To my husband's despair, I had a DJ garage set at my wedding and it was hilarious because it was like this cat, it was like Romeo and Juliet because my husband is, yeah, I do his posh voice, like middle class, you know, not posh, but middle class. And I'm very much Cockney. And there was the Cockney locked dance into garage and then all of his side of the family just looking at us like we were absolute lunatics. And yeah, one friend described it as a council estate Romeo and Juliet, and it was,
I love that.
Yeah, but you know, he still married me. Well, it was done by then, he couldn't get out of it. So I would, you know, I would want garage music. There absolutely has to be macaroni cheese because if you ask anyone, you know, to describe my like Defro dinner or what's Brooke known for, it's macaroni cheese. There must be a rendition sung of Part of Your World from The Little Mermaid because that is my favourite song and my karaoke song. Raz, you're writing this down. Is this something
I've got to find something at the end of this podcast. The garage version of Part of Your World.
Oh, yeah. I wonder if we can make that happen.
Oh, we have to make that happen. Yeah, I would just want it to be like just a celebration of all of the things I love and, yeah, and just fun, basically.
So you got those... You got those songs.
And then what about any readings or performances or what else would it involve?
I'd quite like, I'm just thinking off the cuff now, I'd quite like a as I depart to wherever I'm going, Bugsy Malone, You Give a Little Love is one of my favourite songs. You know, you give a little love and it all comes back to you. So I'd quite like the... not the choir. What are they called? The people that attend your funeral?
Well, the congregation.
The congregation. But I'd actually like them to start from "We Could Have Been Anything That We Wanted to Be."
Oh, yes.
There you go. I'd quite like a little performance of that everybody joined. I don't want the custard pies.
I'm so gutted I won't be alive to direct this show.
You never know, Razzle. You never know. You don't know when it's going to happen. But look, now you know the plan, so keep that safe. Don't lose it like you've lost yours.
Okay, we've written the plan down. Yeah, I know.
We've got the plan. Yeah.
No, that's amazing. So it's a joy. It's joyous. It's joyous, in other words.
Mm.
That I would want it to be joyous, yeah. I mean, look, there's got to be some tears. I'd be a bit upset if, you know, no one cried for me. But, yeah, overall, I would prefer it if it was joyous.
Celebration.
Yes, please.
I love it. I love it. I'm all over it.
Yeah.
I'll leave that with you, Raz, then.
Any readings?
Any readings? Do you know what? Let's go with the end of Ben's essay.
Let's chuck
that in there.
If you want tears, make the mega mix of tears.
That's amazing. We've got to have some tears. Maybe just that. Nothing else is coming to the top of my mind. And actually, I don't think I'd want anything else. Let's have a little memento of Ben.
That all sounds amazing. Great.
Amazing. Thank you.
Thank you, Brooke.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me and for this three therapy session. I hope it wasn't too doom and gloom. I didn't have that intention.
No, it wasn't.
You are never doom and gloom in my world.
It couldn't be doom and gloom with you. Whatever we talked about.
Unfortunately, for Brooke and I, now that restaurants are opening up, the one place that I sadly departed from our lives is the chicken shop.
Oh, the chicken shop.
We should dedicate a whole episode to the chicken shop. Has it closed?
Death to the chicken shop. Oh. I think it's no longer. We used to love the chicken shop, didn't we, Brooks?
We did. And I tried to recreate it for us, didn't I?
Oh, you did. You made me Elsie and had a personal chicken shop only a few weeks ago. And it was fucking glorious.
It was complete beginner's luck. I am not a cook. And I fluked it.
Can I just end this podcast by saying that sums you up? Saying, oh, I'm not a cook, but I made the most amazing chicken. I don't really speak much. I went and talked to Gordon Brown, led a march, etc.
The most self-effacing world changer the world has ever known.
You talk. Thank you.
Thank you so much. What a lovely afternoon. Thank you so much. And love you lots, Raz, and
pleasure to
be a guest. Mwah. Thank you, Hannah. Lovely to meet you. Take care.
Bye.
Bye. Finally, I decide I want to explore this Milky Way, this heaven. I tell everyone I'll be right back. I just want to look around. As I stroll around the never-ending dance floor, I see things that give me a wild mix of fascination and confusion. Things that would seem impossible. But this is heaven, right? Anything is possible here. The ceiling is invisible to the naked eye. It stretches higher than the sky, space higher than anything. Floating platforms raised hundreds of feet into the soft air. I can just make out the young people having the time of their lives. Or deaths. Death. It's not present here. It never will be. It's so alive. It feels and smells like I'm outside on a glorious summer's day in the middle of a beautiful countryside. Yet the reality is, I'm stuck in the middle of the most vast and exciting rave I've ever witnessed. Pure electricity fills us all. It's more than I would expect even God to think up. It's fantastic. Wildly tamed. Nobody sleeps. You just let the music, the people, the atmosphere and the feelings just sweep you away to a place you've longed to be. Everybody's in their very own heaven.
We could have been anything we wanted to be, and it's not too late to change. I'd be delighted to give it some thought. Maybe you'll agree we really ought to be. We could have been anything we wanted to be. Yes, that decision was ours. It's been decided where we could divide it. Let friendship double up our powers. Oh, we could have been anything we wanted to be. And I'm not saying we should. But if we try it, we'd learn to abide it. We could be the best at being good. Flowers of the earth, who can even guess how much a real friend is worth? Good guys, shake an open hand. Maybe we'll be trusted if we try to understand. No doubt about it, it must be worthwhile. Good friends do tend to make you smile. Yeah, we could have been anything we wanted to be. Yes, that decision is ours. It's been decided where we could divide it. Let friendship double of our powers. You give a little love and it all comes back to you. Da 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 da. You're gonna be remembered for the things that you say and do. La 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 la. You give a little love and it all comes back to you. La 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 la. You're gonna be remembered for the things that you say and do. La 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 la. You give a little love and it all comes back to you. La 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 la.
You've been listening to Death and the Elephant, an Elephant production featuring Dr. Hannah Harris and me, Raz Shaw, and edited by the multi-talented Dr. Hannah Harris, with music composed by Mark Melville. The extract from Ben's essay was written by Ben Kinsella and read by Brooke Kinsella. You Give a Little Love was written by Paul Williams and performed by Ryan Kerwin and Johnny Walters. You can reach Ryan on Instagram at Ryan Kerwin Films.